Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. But before we do, some brief housekeeping. In the biggest news, perhaps the biggest news of the year, the decade, the century, next week we will be debuting our first series done in collaboration with the wonderful people over at the We're Not So Different podcast on the First Crusades. The series is called Welcome to the Crusades, the First Crusades. And if it's if you guys like it, we looked forward to doing more of these. There are several more crusades, and we could also do some other geopolitical analysis of earlier events. And we think the series is fun and it's interesting. And we're going to drop probably a couple of episodes for you all to check it out.
It's Eleanor Yanaga. You guys know her.
Yeah, it's Eleanor. You all know Eleanor and Luke and Luke Wallers. Two great people who really know their stuff. And we really do think you'll enjoy it. We'll drop a couple of episodes and then you could purchase the rest of the series. Of course, our lovely subscribers will get a discount. And beyond that, if you haven't yet subscribed to the podcast, please do consider subscribing. And if you can't subscribe, we really do appreciate everyone who's been rating and reviewing the show on Apple. If you haven't done that yet, please do so. We're pretty close to 1,000. And once we get to 1,000, I'll be able to rest easy at night. So with that all said, Derek, why don't we get into it? And with terrible news of the week. This is just, you know, I haven't been able to sleep.
This is a real shocker.
Real shocker. AUKUS. Yeah. Is under review at the Pentagon. So Joe Biden's signature geopolitical achievement might be under threat.
His one accomplishment might be torn to pieces by the capricious Trump administration. The Pentagon said this week that it's reviewing U.S. participation in the AUKUS project. If people don't remember, and I can't imagine there's anybody who doesn't remember AUKUS or where they were when AUKUS was announced, it's that momentous. It's a deal that the U.S. did with Australia and the U.K. in 2021 that mainly involves nuclear-powered attack submarines, i.e. the provision of nuclear-powered attack submarines to Australia, along with the docking rights for the U.S. and U.K. militaries to send their own nuclear-powered submarines to Australia. Totally having nothing to do with China, of course, or the new Cold War. It's completely separate from that, you fools. There was another component that committed or commits the three countries to collaborating on a variety of technologies, some of which are more overtly or less overtly military related, but things like hypersonic missiles and missile defense systems, electronic warfare, AI, all sorts of wonderful new technologies. And of course, if you don't recall AUKUS itself, perhaps you recall Joe Biden reportedly yelling angrily on the phone at a group of Democratic Congress people who were worried about his mental acuity, that they should shut up because he got AUKUS done. And who could have done that besides him? Really was one of his great achievements. Anyway, the Trump administration is reviewing it. I don't think there's much to this. It's a new administration. It's something that the last administration did and kind of obligated the next one to do. It's understandable that they would want to conduct a review. I think Keir Starmer's government in the UK did its own review of AUKUS when the Labour Party took power. So, I mean, it's not out of the question for something like this to happen. There is a record. The person leading the review, Elbridge Colby, who is the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, has criticized elements of AUKUS in the past, and there is some possibility that the administration could come back and say, I mean, there's a slim possibility it could come back and say, this isn't in the U.S. interest at all, we're scrapping it. But the more likely outcome is that it would come back and say, look, there's a couple of things here that we would like to change, and it'll negotiate those things with Australia and the UK. But I don't think they're going to do away with it entirely. Colby himself has never suggested doing away with it entirely in his public comments. He has suggested there are parts of it he doesn't like. But I think he'll probably, if he's really steering the ship, he'll probably steer in a direction of changing it a bit, but not doing away with it entirely. So we can sort of rest easy on that note, I guess. But still, you know, not a 0% chance here that the greatest achievement of the Biden administration could come tumbling down.
Greatest achievement of the 21st century. All right, let's move on.
Well, I mean,
naturally, yes, implied.
But obviously, yeah.
All right, let's move on to Iran, where the IAEA has rebuked Iran while the nuclear negotiations between the U.S. and Iran are going nowhere.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, as I believe we've talked about in our news roundups, has issued a couple of reports recently on Iran's nuclear program, and the most incendiary of them is sort of the culmination of years of back and forth investigations and complaints that the Iranians weren't being fully transparent, investigations into the alleged use of nuclear material at undeclared sites in Iran to conduct research, presumably into aspects of, you know, that would be applicable to a nuclear weapons program if the Iranians decided to pursue one. They issued that report, I believe, a couple of weeks ago, and it was leading up to the IAEA Board of Governors meeting this month. And that meeting took place on Thursday, and the board voted to basically condemn the Iranians for having breached their obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty under international law. The Iranians are quite irritated by this. Of course, they have, I think, announced that they're opening another uranium enrichment site as sort of a thumb to the nose of the IAEA and company. But this was not unexpected. It comes in the backdrop of the U.S. And Iran trying to negotiate, or at least ostensibly trying to negotiate, a nuclear deal. Negotiations are going nowhere, primarily because they can't agree on the issue of uranium enrichment. I'm not even sure the Trump administration agrees internally on the issue of Iranian uranium enrichment. It continues to propose kind of limited enrichment or enrichment under supervision or possibly for a short time. It doesn't have a real solid position here, although Donald Trump himself, every time he talks publicly about this, says Iran cannot be allowed to enrich uranium under any circumstances, period. He seems quite decisive about it. His negotiators seem to be more flexible, but then they lose credibility when their boss says, you know, there's not going to be any enrichment. And the Iranians regard uranium enrichment as not only a matter of energy security for themselves, but as a national right, as a symbol of Iran's sort of independence from the thumb of the Westerners, and as a key sort of element of national pride, and so, you know, under those rubrics, they are unwilling to agree to anything that would require them to give up their uranium enrichment program, or at least to kind of give up the right to enrich uranium. I think there's some flexibility there in the distinction between those two things, but the Trump administration doesn't seem deft enough to exploit it. But the Iranians, it's a red line for them to do anything that would have them kind of committing to no uranium enrichment. They feel like that is a violation of sovereignty. So that's the impasse. With that, then the worry becomes, is there going to be some kind of nuclear or military strike on nuclear targets in Iran, either by the U.S. or by Israel, maybe with U.S. support? I think there would have to be some U.S. support for the Israelis to pull it off, or some kind of collaborative effort. Who knows? But the possibility of that increases the longer these talks go on with no resolution. The Trump administration this week announced that it is withdrawing non-essential staff from the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, and it is relocating military dependents from Middle East bases. This is after the Iranian defense minister, Aziz Nasirzadeh, threatened if the U.S. or Israel do, and or Israel do undertake a strike against Iranian nuclear facilities, the retaliation would come against U.S. facilities in the region. So military bases, potentially, I guess, the embassy in Baghdad, although that would be quite escalatory, but certainly the military bases. So the redeployment of these people, or the evacuation, if you want to put it that way, of these people from these facilities is an indication, I think, that the administration realizes things are potentially coming off the rails, and that's something to certainly be concerned about.
And if something happens, we'll probably do a special on that to let everyone know about it. All right.
Yes, there is another round, I should say. There will be another round of nuclear talks on Sunday. There was some dispute this week over whether it would take place Thursday or Sunday. Trump had apparently said Thursday, but the Iranians insisted that it was scheduled for Sunday. The Omani government, which is mediating, has been mediating all along, said on Thursday that there will be another round of talks on Sunday in Oman. So theoretically, as long as the talks are going on, there's not going to be any shooting, but we'll see how the talks go.
Let's turn to Israel and Palestine, and let's talk about these Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites.
Yeah, this is become an almost daily occurrence. People are familiar with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, this scheme that the U.S. cooked up to kind of centralize the distribution of really minimal amounts of food at nodes across Gaza. There's one in central Gaza, kind of Deir al-Balah, and the rest are located in the south. What's happened is these places have become death traps. People gathering at the sites, aid seekers trying to, you know, navigate whatever Byzantine system of procedures are in place to approach these sites and claim their aid, have been gunned down en masse by Israeli soldiers repeatedly over the last couple of weeks. As I say, almost on a daily basis at this point, I think 57 people were killed in a couple of attacks, IDF attacks near these distribution points, just on Wednesday. And that's been, you know, there were, you know, a few killed on Tuesday, a few killed on Monday. It's really happening just about every day. The IDF repeatedly kind of justifies its actions by claiming that its soldiers fired warning shots at people who were had colored outside the lines, basically had strayed off the whatever path they're supposed to follow, and were approaching in a threatening manner Israeli soldiers. The warning shots wind up invariably killing people, which makes them not warning shots, in fact. But that's the story that the IDF is sticking to. The GHF at one point, I think on Wednesday, basically blamed these starving Palestinians who are trying to, or earlier this week, might not have been Wednesday, but blamed these starving Palestinians who are trying to obtain aid for, again, not following proper procedure, I guess, and, trying to enter in where the exit sign is, I don't know, trying to pull on a push door, whatever. These things get you shot by the IDF, apparently. This is how it works. Late Wednesday, there were reports of an attack by Hamas. Hamas is claimed the attack that killed apparently several GHF workers. I think 8 was the number. I last saw that number may go up. I don't know. But they attacked a bus that was transporting these people in Khan Yunis. The Hamas has insisted that it attacked basically agents, Israeli agents, and whether it identifies the GHF as Israeli agents, or it's talking about something else entirely, and there's a disconnect here, I don't know. But there definitely seems to have been an attack, and the GHF is definitely saying that a number of its aid workers were killed.
Thank you, Derek. Let's stay in the region. Let's talk about the IDF and its apparent relationship with an ISIS-linked group.
The ISIS part of this is a little nebulous, but it's absolutely seems to be established now, and the Israeli government, in fact, Benjamin Netanyahu basically admitted that the IDF is shielding armed groups in Gaza that are opposed ostensibly to Hamas and are working with the IDF. There's one group in particular that was the subject of a report in Haaretz called that calls itself the Anti-Terror Service. It's led by a man named Yasser Abu Shabab, who has a criminal record in Gaza. Make of that what you will, you know, Hamas charging him with the Hamas government of Gaza charged him with something at some point. But the IDF is apparently shielding these guys. They've been accused of looting humanitarian aid convoys coming into Gaza under Israeli protection. And then the Israelis turn around and accuse Hamas of looting the aid, and it becomes a nifty little cycle for them. The claim that I don't think this group, this anti-terror service group, but that there are other groups in Gaza that have ties to Islamic State came, I believe, from Avigdor Lieberman, who's a right-wing Israeli politician, but not part of the Netanyahu coalition, in fact, opposed to Netanyahu, who claimed that the IDF is working with groups that may be affiliated with Islamic State. The Israeli government hasn't commented on that piece of it, but Netanyahu's office did say, basically in response, when it was asked about this story in Haaretz, yes, we're working with armed gangs in Gaza that are opposed to Hamas. So what? Like, what do you want to make of it? Obviously, this is something we would do. But I think it's contributing certainly to the humanitarian crush. It may have contributed to this attack Wednesday night. Perhaps, the Hamas drew some linkage between the people working for GHF and these armed gangs. I don't know. I don't know what the rationale was. But yeah, a lot of murky and unpleasant things happening here.
Let's talk about this Freedom Flotilla with Greta Thunberg.
The Freedom Flotilla was left, the latest attempt, at least, by the Freedom Flotilla coalition to send a fleet to Gaza to deliver aid, left Sicily on June 1st. As you say, Greta Thunberg, the activist, the Swedish activist, was involved. There were a number of other people, a number of other activists, a few French people involved in the flotilla. The IDF basically, under orders from Israel Katz, the Israeli defense minister, who basically said, under no circumstances will we allow this flotilla to deliver humanitarian aid to Gaza, sent the IDF out. They intercepted the coalition late Sunday, boarded the lead vessel, the Madeleine, and took everybody there into custody, including Thunberg. They then deported most of the people. They're deporting all of them eventually, but a few of the people involved challenged their deportation orders in court. So the process was delayed a bit, but they deported, I think, four of the 12 people that they picked up pretty much right away. That included Thunberg and a few other people. So yeah, it's, you know, it obviously did not get any aid. The Israelis claimed that they impounded the aid that they were carrying, and that they will distribute it through proper channels in Gaza. If you believe that, I've got several parcels of land to sell you. But yeah, that was the story. The concern, I think, at one point was that they were going to attack the coalition as they are the flotilla, as they had done previously with the same operation. They did detain these people, arrest them, take them into custody, and then traffic them off or deport them, back home. But there was no bloodshed, at least, which is a step up for the IDF.
Well, in shock among shocks, friend of the pod, Mike Huckabee, has declared that the two-state solution is no more. Derek, what happened?
Shocking stuff. Yeah, this is Huckabee. I don't think articulating the Trump administration's official position, but sort of freelancing, which he tends to do, that telling reporters on Tuesday that he doesn't think that the creation of an independent Palestinian state is still U.S. government policy. He did suggest that a state could be carved out of the territory currently belonging to another Arab state, but made it pretty clear that, at least from his perspective, the notion of a Palestinian state on the territories that were seized by the Israelis in 1967, Gaza and the West Bank, East Jerusalem, is a non-starter. This is basically just a verbalization of what's been U.S. policy for decades now, going maybe all the way back to the 67 war, but certainly for the last quarter century or more. So it's not, hugely surprising. It's a little surprising to see the U.S. ambassador to Israel just openly say it. But it's been obvious for some time now that the U.S. government doesn't really have any interest in shepherding the birth of a Palestinian state.
Let's talk about these sanctions that the United Kingdom has placed on Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich.
This was on Tuesday, the UK, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and Norway all announced jointly that they were blacklisting Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. These are the two far-right pro-settlement, you know, very kind of hardline ministers in Netanyahu's cabinet. They've become the lightning rods for all of the international scorn that should really be heaped on Netanyahu, but people are unwilling to go that far. So yeah, I mean, they're asset freezes, the usual sort of mix of asset freezes and travel bans. So these two would be barred from going to any of these countries. In theory, they would have any assets that they have invested in any of those countries frozen. That's probably not much more than a symbolic gesture. It's probably not a real pain for them, but sanctioning the sitting ministers of a government, even if these are the two lowest hanging fruits in this regard, if you're trying to punish the Israeli government for the violence and the genocide and the settlement activity and all of the transgressions, it's still a pretty big deal. And Smotrich, as the finance minister, there could be some challenges here for Israel's relationship with these five countries, if its finance minister is blacklisted by them. I suspect there will be, you know, workarounds developed to maintain the relationship, because the last thing any of these governments want to do is actually impose any genuine penalties on the Israeli government. They want to be seen as gesturing in that direction without doing anything that's terrible.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
So South Korea has stopped its propaganda broadcasts across the demilitarized zone. What does this mean, Derek?
Yeah, I thought this was interesting because it's the first real gesture by Lee Jae-myung, the new president of South Korea, who won the snap election that was made necessary when Yoon Suk-yeol was impeached and removed from office. It's his first real gesture toward North Korea. The South Korean government has set up these giant loudspeakers basically on its side of the demilitarized zone, broadcasting like K-pop and propaganda feeds, news, whatever, across the DMZ into North Korea. Moon Jae-in, who was former president Moon Jae-in, also from Lee's party, the Democratic Party, had suspended those broadcasts under an agreement with the North Korean government back in 2018. But then after, people may recall the wonderful campaign where the North Koreans kept flying balloons full of trash into South Korea and they would fall and the trash would go everywhere. The South Korean government under Yoon restarted those broadcasts in retaliation for that trash balloon campaign. In addition to being very irritating to the North Korean government, which Lee has said he would like to try and improve relations with, these loudspeakers are also unsurprisingly pretty unpleasant for any South Koreans who happen to live within hearing distance of them. And Lee has said on that basis alone, he was interested in ending these broadcasts. But add to that the geopolitical aspect where he's trying to make a gesture to Pyongyang. And it was a pretty easy decision for him to make, I think, to stop these broadcasts.
All right, Derek, let's move on to Sudan, where the military has lost border outposts after an alleged attack by Libyan forces.
The Rapid Support Forces militants have seized control of what's known as the Triangle region, which is a region in far northwestern Sudan that borders both Egypt and Libya. This comes after the Sudanese military withdrew from its outposts in that region, having accused Khalifa Haftar and the so-called Libyan National Army, his militia, of attacking those outposts. The Sudanese military has accused Haftar in the past of supporting the RSF, but mostly through, like, you know, enabling weapon smuggling from Libyan territory to the RSF, you know, kind of indirect support. This is the first time it's accused him and the LNA of getting directly involved in the conflict and attacking Sudanese military positions. There's no confirmation that that's really what happened. It is confirmed that the RSF has moved into this area and taken it over, that the military withdrew. So, you know, it's an interesting coincidence if you know, the military is trying to fabricate a story here. I haven't seen any comment from Haftar or from his Eastern, Libyan government, the Libyan government that he sort of controls. I also haven't seen any comment from the Egyptian government. And this is very awkward, I think, for Egypt, because it has supported Haftar in his conflict with the rival Western Libyan government. But it also supports the Sudanese military in its conflict against the RSF. So the fact that Haftar and the RSF are working together, whether or not that's escalated to the point where Haftar is now openly, you know, at war with the Sudanese military or not, the fact that he's working with the RSF, which is pretty well established, is certainly awkward for the Egyptians. The common denominator here is the United Arab Emirates, which supports both Haftar and the RSF, and kind of oversees, you know, arming and supporting both of those groups and the weapons that are allegedly, you know, have allegedly been funneled into Sudan via Haftar controlled territory in Libya, are almost certainly being paid for by the UAE. So that's the common string here, common thread tying them together.
Thanks, Derek. So tell us about these Russian military advances into another Ukrainian province.
Yeah, so the Russians have been advancing in Sumy Oblast, as people I'm sure are aware. That's in northeastern, kind of northern northeastern Ukraine, opposite Kursk Oblast, where the Ukrainians had invaded Russia and have been driven back. The Russians have been moving toward the city of Sumy. They're still doing that. But the bigger story over the past few days has been the Russians advanced through Donetsk Oblast, which they're almost entirely in control of, not quite, but they're getting there, advanced from Donetsk into Dnipropetrovsk Oblast, which is more kind of central Ukraine. It's a major industrial hub and a brand new province. The Russians had not set foot inside that province yet since they invaded in 2022. So a major setback, I think, for the Ukrainians to have Russian forces in Dnipropetrovsk. They've been moving closer and closer to the border of that province for some time now, but now it seems they're seizing territory on the ostensibly Ukrainian side of the provincial border, trying to set up a buffer zone that would protect their gains in Donetsk. If they go beyond that, it would be a massive strategic loss for Ukraine. It would be really, really major setback.
So we'll keep our eyes on that. All right, Derek, tell us about the Polish government surviving a no confidence vote.
Yes, as people may recall, Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk sought a no confidence vote after Karol Nawrocki, the right wing candidate, won Poland's presidential runoff earlier this month. They held that vote on Wednesday, and to no surprise, Tusk, his coalition, still has a majority in parliament. It held together, and he won. I think Tusk mostly wanted to do this for the symbolic value of demonstrating that he's still got a parliamentary majority, because he and Nawrocki, when Nawrocki takes office in August, are likely to butt heads on a lot of things. They're not politically aligned. So he just wanted to have it established that he's got control of the parliament heading into what is likely to be a tumultuous relationship with the new president.
Let's move on to NATO, where apparently the countries in NATO are striving to hit Trump's 5% spending demand.
Right. So the Secretary General of NATO, Mark Rutte, told reporters last week after a meeting of the alliance's defense ministers on Thursday in Brussels that there is broad support among member states for a proposal to raise defense spending levels, the sort of minimum defense spending levels for member states, to 5% of GDP. This is in line with what Donald Trump has demanded since coming back into office. He's been famously angry about NATO members not paying what he calls their dues. And this is the next iteration of that. He used to want 3%. Now he wants 5%, which even the U.S. doesn't hit. But the idea is to sort of massage this a little bit. The proposal that Rutte has put forward that seems to be the one that's getting all the support and has the apparent backing of the Trump administration as well is that members would be obliged to spend 3.5% of GDP on strictly military spending, strictly defense spending, as it's normally defined. The other 1.5% could be spent on infrastructure that has military applications. So improving airports, bridges, you know, I'm sure there's cyber projects that they could be doing, all manner of things that could also have civilian application and would not necessarily take a bite out of the civilian infrastructure budget, but could be kind of categorized as also military spending under this this kind of military plus rule that NATO is trying to adopt.
All right, let's talk about the Trump administration creating a quote-unquote Office of Remigration or Remigration at the State Department.
Right. So people are probably aware that the Trump administration has been planning to reorganize the State Department. It's still kind of kicking around a reorg chart. And, you know, it's asked for a substantially lower State Department budget next year than the State Department is enjoying this year. But the final reorganization plan is still not in place. What does seem to be in place, as you said, is this Office of Remigration. DropSite reported on this a few days ago, sort of the latest org chart, which still has the Office of Remigration in it. There's been reporting about this at other outlets. Wired, I think, reported on it. Marissa Cabas, the journalist, at her newsletter, The Handbasket, also reported on it. Basically, they're taking an idea out of the bowels of the European far right and installing a deportation office at the State Department. It would work with Homeland Security and the other various other deportation offices that the federal government has to enable, streamline, I guess, to the extent possible, the deportation of migrants, presumably undocumented, although who really knows at this point, probably would have something to do with deporting students who say some unthink or wrong think on Israel or you know, the various other causes that the administration has taken up for kicking people out of the country. But as I say, this is taken from really like a language used by the farthest right xenophobe extremists in Europe. And so it's probably not surprising, I guess, that it's migrated into the Trump administration. It would be housed, at least according to the latest org chart, in the Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration, which is supposed to handle asylum cases and people coming into the country who are seeking solace here. Instead, I guess that office will be, or at least part of it, will be repurposed to kicking those people back out of the United States in the good, wholesome way that we're doing.
And finally, let's talk about the new Cold War. Has the U.S.-China trade talks led to an actual deal?
Right. So there was another round of trade talks in London this week. They started on Monday. They extended into a second day on Tuesday, which was taken as a somewhat positive sign. Following up on the negotiations in Geneva last month that had produced a sort of detente in the trade war between the U.S. and China, that detente started to fray as Donald Trump took to social media to type screeds about China not keeping its commitments or the commitments that it made in Geneva, particularly around, it seems, the issue of critical minerals, rare earths is the term that Trump likes, I think, because it makes them sound like diamonds, because they're rare and they must be good then if they're rare. So he gets all excited about it. But he was very angry that China had not relaxed its export restrictions on critical minerals coming to the U.S. And China has a bottleneck on most of the critical minerals, things like lithium, graphite, et cetera, that are used in high-tech chips and other things. China has a real stranglehold on that trade. So its export controls were taking a hefty bite out of American companies, supply chains, et cetera. So Trump was angry about that. He and Xi Jinping, as you may recall, had a phone call a few days ago and then decided to send their representatives to London for this meeting. The deal that was produced, according to Trump, who says it's done pending approval by him and Xi, involves a reduction of tariffs. The U.S. will have a 55% tariff on Chinese imports going forward, according to Trump. That includes about 25%, given give or take on whichever product you're looking at, was already in place. So it's about 30% that Trump has imposed on top of that, 20% being related to his fentanyl tariff, which he did very, very soon after taking office, and then another 10% in this sort of reciprocal tariff framework that he's devised for himself. China will maintain, according to him, a 10% tariff on U.S. products. China has a larger tariff than that on U.S. products. So I don't really know what he's talking about there. I don't think the plan is for China to reduce its tariffs on U.S. products. So not entirely clear what Trump was talking about there. But on the real thing that he cares about, which is the rare earths deal, China has apparently agreed to loosen its export restrictions, start approving the sale and export of those products to U.S. companies. And in return, there's this package of things that Trump lumped under the heading of what was agreed to that the U.S. will provide to China. It's unclear what exactly is entailed here. Clearly, there's going to be a relaxation of the restrictions that the administration placed very recently on Chinese students attending U.S. educational institutions. So student visas may start being issued again. According to the Wall Street Journal, there will also be a relaxation on U.S. export controls on certain products, jet engines, chemicals, certain chemicals used in manufacturing plastics. So some products that China wants, the U.S. government has been restricting. Those restrictions will be lifted. Restrictions on high-tech products like advanced AI chips, semiconductor components, the things that the Biden administration in particular really kind of clamped down on sending to China and that the Trump administration has continued, those are apparently not on the table. The catch here is that this relaxation that China has imposed or has put in place or has agreed to put in place on its critical minerals exports only goes for 6 months. So they're giving themselves an opportunity to renegotiate in a fairly short period of time if they're unhappy with what they're getting from the U.S. or they're unhappy with the manner in which the Trump administration is trying to comply with this new deal that was reached in London. There's also some question as to how done this deal actually is, Trump's comments notwithstanding. The Chinese Commerce Ministry on Thursday kind of discussed what had happened in London, and the suggestion out of the ministry was that this was just the first step in a longer negotiation that needs to happen. Whatever framework, they spoke of a framework coming out of London, not a done deal as Trump had characterized it, and that there would be more work that needs to be done to really get an implementable deal in place end, I guess, the trade war, at least for the time being. So some disagreement on exactly what was committed to. And I think Trump may be overselling it a bit, and that could wind up making him angry. And we'll see more social media screeds from him in a couple of weeks. Who knows? Anything is possible. But it does seem like the tension that had emerged after the Geneva meeting has subsided somewhat in the wake of this London meeting, and maybe that's put things on a more positive path. We'll have to wait and see.
Well, thank you everyone for listening, and please like and review the podcast. And please check out our series, Welcome to the Crusades, which will be dropping next week. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.